Now that this week in global history is history, it's time to sit back, relax, and relive the week that was in global history class. Coming to you live from 235, Mr. Palumbo is ready to take you on a journey into the past to understand the present and change the future. Welcome to Enduring Issues.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to Enduring Issues for the third week of December 2019, the last episode of Enduring Issues for the year. This episode is really part three of our large and encompassing unit that we do on World War One up through World War Two. The first one, if you haven't listened to it yet, go back and check that out for World War One. The middle, our interwar years, entitled Rise of Dictators. Check that one out. And this one here is going to take us basically covering a few years before World War II, all the way up through including it, and some effects afterwards. This is all done. These three episodes are done in combination to help you guys with your unit exam, which is scheduled for Thursday, December 19th. Right before holiday break. So thanks for tuning in and listening to this one. Hopefully you get a chance to check out all three if you haven't already. So what we left off on the Rise of Dictators episode of the podcast was we're just breaking down some of the similarities and differences with Hitler and Mussolini. It was a time period that we called Mad Men Week, where we learned about Vladimir Lenin, the things he did with the Russian Revolution. We got into Hitler and Mussolini, the reasons for their rise to power in their respective countries, the economic situation and the desperation of the people there as a result of the after effects of World War One. So for this week, we're going to get and move a little bit closer to World War Two. We still have one madman to take care of and to learn about that we took care of the very beginning of last week. And that, of course, is Joseph Stalin. Joseph Stalin's going to come to power in the Soviet Union after the death of Vladimir Lenin. There's a bit of a power struggle after that. But we jump right into the reign of Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union. The things we looked at for him are his economic plans and the effects and impacts of those. He calls these his five-year plans. These five-year plans, the purpose of which is to rapidly industrialize the Soviet Union so it can compete with some of the more industrial powers of the West. This rapid industrialization is going to have massive impacts throughout the Soviet Union. The first one is, if you think about it, the whole nation, all the power of the Soviet Union is going to be focused on industrialization and creating industrial products, right? Making machines and tools and weapons and all those different things. The issue with that is, of course, that the people can't eat steel, right? They can't eat coal or trains or things like that. So with the rise of industrial products, we also see a decline in agriculture, right, as the focus of the country shifts. To make up for that, Stalin's going to put some things in place to improve agricultural output as well. Following the communist plan and the communist principle, right, of shared ownership of things and state-controlled and government-run and owned and controlled industries, you know, no private property, one of those things that's going to be taken from people is their land. Their land and their tools are going to come under control of the state, under control of Stalin. He's going to take all the farmland in the Soviet Union, which is in the western part, right? The part that's more hospitable, where they have the climate and soil to actually have agriculture. And he's going to collectivize that farmland, right? This concept of collectivization, taking many smaller, privately owned farms and putting that all under control of the government. All the people that had previously lived on those individual plots of land are going to live and work together, right, on these communes under this plan of collectivization and produce agricultural products for the benefit of the state, right? They're going to have certain quotas they're going to have to meet of agricultural products that they're going to have to turn over to the government. Not meeting those quotas is going to be met with some pretty harsh punishments. Things like being sent to the gulag, right, these forced labor camps, mostly in Siberia, right, where many people are just worked to death. So the economic plans of Stalin are things we look at. We look at his ruthless nature, right? That one example we just mentioned, right? Sending people to work to death in the gulags. He's going to have purges where he eliminates his political enemies, right? Killing hundreds of thousands of people in these purges. And the main atrocity associated with Joseph Stalin at this time is known as the Holodomor. Holodomor is kind of the official, you know, socialized term for this, also known as the Ukrainian famine. And that even of itself, Ukrainian famine, isn't even an appropriate title. When you think famine, you think some sort of natural disaster, like the Irish potato famine, right? Something that happens to the crops. But this is very much a completely man-made disaster, all right? If the Ukraine, if you just think of a map of Europe and where, you know, Russia and Ukraine are today, Ukraine is south and west of Russia, right? So if you need to find any fertile soil and fertile land in Europe, right, you're going to have to go further south where it's a little bit warmer, right, and further west where the land's going to be a little bit better. Ukraine is known as the breadbasket of Europe, right? It has the most hospitable conditions to grow wheat and grain, things like that. That's used to make bread. And during this time, it's under control of Joseph Stalin, all right, and the Soviet Union. Stalin's going to be unhappy with many of the landowners there in the Ukraine. They've been resisting his plans for collectivization. So what he's going to do to punish them is he's going to raise their quotas, right? He's going to say, you need to provide even more agricultural products to the state. Now, what that does is it makes it so there's no more food left for the Ukrainians to have themselves, right? They're still able to produce quite a lot, but they have to give it all to Stalin, right? Remember what happens if you don't give it to him, right? It's to the gulag. So this Ukrainian famine is going to kill tens of millions of people in the Ukraine in a relatively short period of time, right? And it shows the ruthlessness of Joseph Stalin. The famous quote we associate of that with him is, you know, one death is a tragedy and a million is a statistic, right? Showing his heartless nature there with the Holodomor and the Ukrainian famine. From there, we moved on to the causes of World War II. What's going on in the 1930s in Europe that's going to lead towards World War, right? We already know that Hitler and Mussolini are in place in Germany and in Italy. Stalin is in charge in the Soviet Union. So what actions, what are they doing there that's going to lead the world to war? The focus is going to be on Hitler in Germany and his actions. What he's doing is he's really going against everything that the Treaty of Versailles says, right? The conditions of the Treaty of Versailles, as you recall, are very harsh to Germany, making him pay all sorts of reparations, give a lot of colonial possessions back. But there's other things, there's other restrictions, things like Germany has to limit the size of their military, right? They're not able to rearm with airplanes and tanks. They're not allowed to enlist, more than a certain number of troops. They're not allowed to take any extra land. Hitler is going to go completely against this, right? He's going to kind of poke at the French and the English. Those are in charge of enforcing the Treaty of Versailles. He's going to start taking over little bits of land. He's going to start rebuilding his military, right? Mostly in secret, but he's going to, go against all those provisions of the Treaty of Versailles to see if any of those European powers, the British or the French, will do anything about it. And he quickly finds out that they won't, right? He takes the Rhineland, he walks in and takes that. The British and the French let him, right? He takes parts of Czechoslovakia, the British and the French let him. He takes other areas in and around Germany. The British and the French let him do it, right? And this is the vocab term of appeasement, right? Giving in to an aggressor. And we ask the question, why are the British and French just letting Hitler take all this land, right? And the answer is relatively simple, right? They want to avoid conflict. They want to avoid a war, right? They know the only way to stop him is to send in their own troops and tanks to physically stop him, and that could lead to another world war. So they're going to let him take these places, right? And the policy of appeasement. One of the final steps in this, European powers are going to meet at the Munich Conference in 1938, just to kind of tell Hitler not to take any more land, to get an agreement from him, a promise from him that he won't take any more land. And a deal is reached where Hitler gets a little bit of Czechoslovakia in exchange for saying he's not going to take anything else. Obviously, making a deal with Hitler is not very wise, and it's not going to work out too terribly well for Europe. Less than a year later, about 11 months later, Hitler invades Poland in September of 1939. And this is the final straw for the British. And they're going to declare war on Nazi Germany. All right, so the war is officially going to start there in September of 1939. We took one day to take a look at some of the battles that take place during World War II, some of the main ones, just to get a sense of their impact, a little bit of a timeline of when they happen. There's a whole Google Slides presentation that is still there for everybody in your Schoology. But we looked at the Battle of Britain, right, the air battle over the skies of London. We looked at that invasion of Poland originally, an invasion of Czechoslovakia, D-Day, the Battle of the Bulge. Just to get a sense of what the fighting was like, because that was a bit of a focus we had for World War One, so we wanted to see the similarities and differences there. Moving on from that, we moved on to one of the main historical events that comes from World War II. And that is, of course, the Holocaust. This is an event that is, you know, honestly tremendously serious to be learning about and talking about. It's one that most everyone is pretty familiar with, the basics of it, right? So we start out talking about those basics just to make sure we're all on the same page of, you know, the who, where, what, and when of the Holocaust. And questions that you guys still had revolved around the why and the how, right? Why did this happen? Why did Hitler do it? How were the people of Germany, you know, able to follow along with this or to go along with this plan? And that's what we wanted to take a look at, right? So to do that, we took some primary sources, right, to go exactly to that time period, to put ourselves in 1930s and 1940s Germany, to see and to hear and to read what the people of Germany were seeing and hearing and reading. At the time, we looked at a ton of primary source documents, of propaganda posters. We looked at speeches from Adolf Hitler, Joseph Goebbels. We looked at sections of Mein Kampf, just to get a sense of the propaganda, of what was being put into the heads of the German people at this time. And recalling from weeks previous, right, Germany's going through this depression, right? People there are struggling. And what Hitler does with this propaganda is he puts that blame on the Jews, right? He blames them for the terrible economy. He blames them for starting and kind of the reason for World War II. He paints them, you know, physically paints them in a just terrible light with, you know, fangs and warts and, you know, all sorts of different terrible things that put this picture in the German people's heads of what the Jewish people look like and act like, you know, when for some cases they may not have never met, right, a Jewish person. So when you get to, you know, the Holocaust and those terrible scenes that, you know, we've seen in different classes before, you know, if you're in Germany at the time, you're not even thinking of it as 6 million people, right, being sent to camps, because Hitler does a, you know, such an effective job of dehumanizing the Jewish people before the Holocaust, conditioning the people of Germany to think a certain way about the Jewish population. And not just the Jewish population, but many other populations in the area. The disabled, mentally and physically disabled, gypsies, and many, many others. From there, we started this week with a great presentation from Ms. Miller, from Hobart William Smith, talking further about remembrances of the Holocaust, things that are still in place in Germany and Poland today, to help us and to help people remember those events, right, to absolutely you know, prevent those things from happening again. From there, we jumped to a completely different part of the world, right? Most of our focus for this unit has been centered on Europe, you know, Germany, the Soviet Union, Italy, you know, events going on there. We jumped to the other side of the globe and went to Japan and saw what war was like in the Pacific area, right? The Pacific Theater, it's called. To see what, you know, Japan is doing during the same time period, the 1930s and 40s into World War II. To have our discussion with this, we couldn't just start, obviously, with learning about Japan and World War II, right? We can't just start with that. You always need to go back, right, and see how we got here, why we got here. We went all the way back, millions of years even, to the geography of Japan, right? The geographic features that make up Japan, the archipelago of Japan. And we looked at a topographical map and saw that it's basically, you know, a bunch of rocks in the ocean, right? And if you're living on a bunch of rocks in the ocean, you're going to lack many natural resources. So when Japan wants to modernize, wants to industrialize, wants its economy to join those of the West, they're going to be limited, right? They're not going to have a lot of the resources that you need to do that. So when a country needs resources that they don't have, they're going to look outwards, right? They're going to look to gain those in other places. So Japan's going to start a policy of imperialism. Now, we've looked at this a little bit when we did the Russo-Japanese War back in 1905. You know, this is a situation where Japan is looking to the West, trying to gain some land on mainland in Asia, so like in Korea and China, and where they run into the Russians. So that's an important event in this timeline, something we've covered already. But they're going to try to gain more land there, more land in Korea, more land in China, to try to get those resources. One of the events there that's going to take place because of that, because of this interaction between the Japanese and the Chinese, is the Rape of Nanking, the terrible atrocities the Japanese army are going to have on the people of Nanking, anywhere between 200,000 and 300,000 people are going to be killed. You know, Chinese citizens are going to be killed there during the Rape of Nanking and many other atrocities as well. That's just one step in, you know, Japanese history for this time period. Not just mainland China and Korea, mainland China and Korea are they going to be taking, but the Japanese are also going to look the other direction, out into the Pacific, taking over different islands in the Pacific region. And their goal to do that, obviously, is to completely control the Pacific. To do that, they need first a lot of natural resources, right? So they can build up their navy, they can fuel their navy. One of their sources of oil during this time is from the United States. And the United States, seeing Japanese aggression in Asia, is going to cut off their oil supply. It's going to have an oil embargo against them. So that's really going to sour relations between the United States and Japan. Japan's also going to see the United States as their main adversary, right? The only country that's going to be able to stop complete Japanese domination of the Pacific. So on December 7th, 1941, right, a date that will live in infamy, Japan is going to launch a surprise attack on the United States naval base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii as a way to jump out and try to knock out the United States Pacific Fleet, freeing Japan to completely control the Pacific, right, without any anyone stepping up or being able to stop them. This is going to launch the United States into World War II. The United States is going to declare war on Japan the following day, and this is going to lead to America's entrance into World War II. That, for the most part, is going to be kind of U.S. history based topics, things that you'll take care of in U.S. history class. We're still focused, obviously, on the global perspective of it. So we looked a little bit at some of the battles between the United States and Japan, this concept of island hopping, right, where the United States has to fight and win each individual little island throughout the Pacific and try to take it back from the Japanese, coming ever closer to, you know, the mainland, or, you know, the bigger islands of Japan itself, getting closer and closer as you get towards war's end. But we do know from prior learning, you know, that Japanese spirit, that samurai spirit of never giving up, never surrendering. You know, there's no honor in surrender. So the fighting in these islands is absolutely brutal, right? Japan's going to fight to the last man. And so that's going to lead to the United States having to make a decision, right? As they get closer to the islands of Japan, they have to decide if they're going to invade Japan with a traditional military force, or they have this new weapon that they've developed called the atomic bomb, if they're going to use this against Japan. After many warnings to surrender, on August 6, 1945, the United States drops the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, killing 70,000. More warnings are given to surrender. Japan doesn't. On August 9th, a second atomic bomb is dropped on the city of Nagasaki, killing another 40,000. And it is after this that Japan does finally surrender on August 15th, 1945, officially ending World War II. So that's kind of the end of the war itself. There are some events immediately after it that we did cover and take care of. Those two things are the Nuremberg trials and the Tokyo trials. These are trials in which leaders of Nazi Germany and leaders of Imperial Japan are put on trial for their war crimes and atrocities during World War II, for their what are called crimes against humanity. And in both cases, leaders are held responsible. Many are sent to be executed. Many are given long prison terms. These international tribunals, these military courts at Nuremberg and at Tokyo, and it sets that precedent that world leaders are responsible for war crimes of their nations, and they can't commit these crimes against humanity, these atrocities, these genocides, without being held to account. Now, that wraps up the work we did for this World War I through World War II unit. It was a long one. Thanks for staying with us. Be sure to be looking over all of your notes, all those things we did with review activities today, listening to all three episodes of the Enduring Issues podcast. And with that, hopefully you're in a good place and come in ready to rock and roll for your test tomorrow. All right. Have a great night, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
We hope you've enjoyed this look back into the week that was in global history. The goal, as always, is to be enlightened. If not enlightened, at least entertained. For global updates throughout the week, follow Mr. P on Twitter at Mr. P_Braves. And remember, this isn't just his story or her story. It's your story, too.